Good morning. Today's Saturday, 22nd day of April.
Is that right?
Am I right?
What you're looking at
yep,
there is...
Yep, the old one. 22nd, it's now 9:45, and we're going to start out with the calendar that we had on the 20th of April this morning, and we'll start with Dave. Dave, if you want to come up, or whoever. We have the sponsor of Senate Bill 313. Senator Terrio is with us this morning. Senator Terrio.
Mr. Chairman, due to demands on my time, Mr. Stancliffe has done most of the research on the bill. I've conferred with him, but I think for efficiency this morning, if he would just go ahead and present the bill.
And if all, for the record, all members are present. Mr. Stancliffe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Today before you is a bill dealing with a psychotropic substance. That's a substance that, when taken in sufficient quantity, will produce hallucinogenic effects. It's a very old substance, originally used in very limited ways by the Mesotec Indians in the mountains of Mexico to produce visions and to open their minds in what they refer to as a religious and spiritualistic experience. Like a lot of similar substances, mescaline, peyote, LSD, as the use has become more widespread, this still being one of the legal hallucinogenic drugs in every state but two, and with the proliferation of internet sales around the world, this substance that was used by a very small cultural group is now getting into the smoke shops in Anchorage and Fairbanks, coming into our state over the internet. The sellers and the purveyors of this substance give grave warnings about its use. The chat rooms are full of warnings from experienced mind travelers, those people who have over the years seen fit to use other hallucinogenic substances. We have a letter from Health and Social Services, a position of support from the Department of Law, and also Public Safety. Chris Boeheim is online if necessary to explain their support. The DEA has looked at this substance very seriously. Congress has had a bill before them. Louisiana and Missouri have banned the substance, as have seven other countries, including some such as Australia, Belgium, Denmark, Finland, Norway, Iceland, Estonia, Spain. Other countries are looking at banning it. And the reason is quite simple. For some people, this can be a pleasant experience, but it only takes 250 micrograms, which is a millionth of a gram, to send a person into a hallucinogenic state. Very easy to overdose, even for experienced users, and go into a catatonic state or a state of lack of physical control. And that's really only part of the problem. Studies have shown that people predisposed toward depression or schizophrenia can be tipped further in that direction by this particular drug. There are some long-term residual effects, such as flashbacks. Even though some people only describe a high that lasts minutes, others describe a high that lasts hours and effects that last days. This is, without a doubt, and it's undisputed, the most potent natural hallucinogenic material known to man. The drug within it, which is contained in a CS that before you, possibly to be adopted, is Salvinorum A. And that's the substance within the plant Salvia divinorum that actually caused this hallucinogenic effect. So the question is, I suppose, from a policy standpoint, should we send a message to the people who are putting this into our state that we're not open for this type of business? You might take note that when that happens, whether it's a country or state, there's several sites out on the internet that immediately post the places that do not allow legal importation of the substance. So the question of whether or not this will be effective, I think, is answered with a resounding yes, because once a place is illegal, Everyone knows, the dealers know, the internet sites know, and the importation starts to dry up. Now, in fairness to some of the people that have contacted us, and there's been two, we've had 7 people contact us, 4 from out of state, 3 from in state, 2 opposed to the idea of complete banning, although they do support no sales to minors and controlling the substance. They report some positive effects for them personally, and they may be online and speak to that. The preponderance of evidence shows that, number one, this is every bit as powerful as any other hallucinogenic substance, more powerful than many, easily obtained with a click of a mouse if you say you're 18, and it is growing worldwide and coming into our state. There's bills before the New York legislature. The Senate has passed a measure, and it's in the works to do what we're doing here today. Delaware has what they call Brett's Law before them, and I understand now there's one other state, I believe it's Tennessee now, acting upon this substance. I have a mountain of material. You don't have a lot of time. I'd be happy to answer any questions if I could, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for the sponsor's representative. Senator Guest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dave, we got an email and an article regarding impacts on depression. If we went down this road, could someone who suffered from depression, who got relief from that depression with this drug, still be able to access it in some manner?
Mr. Chairman, I emailed at least one person who had asked a similar question without revealing their name. The answer is yes. I called our drafters and I said, this is Schedule 2, other substances with permission and a doctor's supervision, could it be used? And the answer from the drafter is absolutely yes. Can it be used for scientific study? Also, the answer is yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have before us a new work draft, a new CS titled / G at the upper for golf. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Terrio?
Mr. Chairman, I would move the / G version as a working document before the committee.
Is there objection? Hearing none, it's adopted. Senator French.
Thank you. Just one question for Mr. Stancliffe. I was going to look up this morning, but I didn't get to checking what the penalties are for illegal possession or distribution of Schedule 2A substances are.
Well, unlike Schedule 1, Senator French, of the chair, you were talking about Class B, Class C versus Class A misdemeanors, whether it's near a school ground, whether it's sold, whether it's possessed, or whether it's raised. One of the things the committee should know about this particular substance is it cannot easily be grown from seed. This isn't a particular problem. It has to be cuttings. It has to be a very carefully controlled environment. Outside of Mexico, the only place this is grown is Hawaii and California. Within the Americas.
Go ahead, Senator French.
I guess my question is some misguided teenager or adult, either one, you know, gets on the internet, clicks and buys some Salvia divinorum and arrives in their, let's say an adult buys the stuff off the internet, arrives in their post office box, and a DEA agent comes along with it and arrests the person. What are the penalties for having bought this material and possessed it?
It, Mr. Chairman, the same as it would be for LSD or cocaine or mescaline or peyote, it would be a Class C.
Class C felony for simple possession.
Yes.
That's what I was trying to get at. So I could have asked it better. Thank you.
Sorry.
Other questions? Hearing none at the moment, we'll go to public testimony. We'll have in Anchorage Jack Degenstein. Jack, are you with us this morning?
Yeah, can you hear me?
We can hear you, sir. If you'll introduce yourself to the committee, we're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
All right, my name is Jack Degenstein, and I'm representing a growing group of Alaskans who believe that Salvia divinorum is not a problem in Alaska. Most of the users use it in a responsible manner, and a lot of the facts that have been out there have really been over-exaggerated, skewed, to say a few things, and I think there needs to be a lot more study looked into the subject to see that it truly is a problem before anything is done about it, because right now it's not a problem, and there's nothing to say that it ever would be a problem. And as far as saying things like there have been studies that have shown that it leads to depression, I've never seen any studies. I'd like to see the studies that Dave Sandcliffe said that he was looking at. There have been speculation, but all studies have actually shown that it reduces depression possibly, but there's never been any true evidence to say that it causes any depression. And also the effects that last days and hours, it's not an effect caused by the drug generally, but more of a some people don't usually describe the effects that last days as being bad, but rather it's not a high. The effect that lasts days is not a high. It is more of a, I don't want to sound cliche, but it's like an enlightenment. It gave them some hope in life, maybe. People have reported that it eases their opiate addiction so that they no longer feel the urge to constantly use opiates or things like crack cocaine. When it's compared to other drugs, it really can't be compared to other hallucinogens and stuff, because any of the sites that you go to will proclaim that it's very atypical, it's not like anything else, it is completely different in the sense that it's not really something to do to get high, it's not common in the drug culture to use this to get high. Drug dealers don't sell it regularly. I've never seen anyone sell it. But it certainly is possible. But really, it's unheard of that drug dealers sell this stuff, and that they ever would be selling it, because it's not a demand for the public doesn't demand this stuff. The people that use it take it very seriously, and also. The safety reasons, people do warn, but they don't put grave warnings on the internet. It's a warning simply, just to ensure that the safety happens. And, there's a lot of things out there that you can't do alone, but is a warning needed? Yes, the warning's needed so that, you don't want to be doing a lot of stuff alone that is legal currently, not drugs. I'm talking about anything recreationally that, you don't want to lift weights alone. People warn that you need to have someone there for lifting weights. And, is that dangerous? No, it's not dangerous when certain precautions are taken into effect. And that's all I got to say.
Mr. Degenstein, is it safe to operate equipment and drive a car when you're using this drug?
I believe that it is, if you're to the level where I believe it's impossible to operate equipment unless you're at lower doses, but at lower doses, it doesn't take your inhibition away to keep you from operating equipment.
So at higher doses, your inhibition is gone?
At higher doses, your inhibition is gone, but also your control is gone. The people that go into catatonic state, it only lasts a few minutes, they would not be able to comprehend using their body to do something.
Okay. Other questions for Mr. Degenstein? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony this morning, Mr. Degenstein.
Yep.
We have a couple people to answer questions. We have Stacy Toner from Social Services, and also Chris Boeheim. Any questions of the members to either of these folks? You have the letter from Stacy, I think, as part of your packet. Senator French?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for Chris Boeheim, if he's on the line listening.
Chris, are you there?
Yes, I am.
If you would introduce yourself for the record, sir.
Yes, my name is Chris Boeheim. I'm the supervisor of the State Crime Laboratory in Anchorage.
Go ahead, Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Chris. Have you reviewed some of the materials that have been submitted to the committee? Have you seen any of the materials that come from a group in I'd never heard or seen of them until this morning, but it looks like they're something called the Center for Cognitive Liberty, and one of them contains some testimony, it looks like, before a committee in Congress by a person named Daniel Seibert. I think he's published in the Journal of Ethnopharmacology. Have you reviewed any of that material, Chris?
No, Senator French, through the chair, I have not. My review has been mostly dealing with the problems that might be associated at the laboratory, whether or not we have the proper equipment to do the testing, and talking to other states, specifically Missouri, that has this control. We do have existing equipment that would enable us to do a chemical analysis on the active ingredient in the plant. So that's basically where my investigation has led.
I see. You're simply here today to tell us that if we make this illegal and someone brings you a sample of the material, that you can test it and testify in court as to whether or not this would fit within the definition that we've got in the bill in front of us.
That is correct. Once we obtain an authentic sample of the active ingredient that we use to calibrate our equipment and use as a reference material.
And up until now, has anybody brought you a sample of this stuff?
No.
Thank you.
Other questions? Hearing none, do we have anyone in the audience that wants to testify on this bill this morning? Seeing none, we will close public testimony on the bill and ask for discussion among the members. Senator Terrio.
Mr. Chairman, it just strikes me from the discussion that's going on across the nation, different state legislatures, that that this is a substance that, while it may be difficult because of its form when it's just dried leaves to be able to tell immediately whether it is in fact this drug, right now the message is that, you know, it's not sold by drug dealers because you can go down the street and buy it. It may come in a little package, and it may say that it's for incense purposes. You're not supposed to, you know, actually consume it, but we know that that it is being used for that purpose. At the very least, I think we need to send the message that we don't believe it's appropriate for it to be used in that way. The allowance for it to be used or prescribed for, perhaps there is a heroin addict or cocaine addict that needs to utilize this as part of their treatment program to, you know, come down off the cravings from use of that particular drug, and this might help, but a medical provider could allow that. So I think that adding it to the list is a common step or a common sense step at this point, so that we not get down the road a couple of years when there's widespread use and we're trying to step in and get control of the situation at that point.
Thank you. Other discussion? Mr. Stancliffe, there are other salvia plants, aren't there?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dave Stancliffe, staff to Senator Terrio. Yes, there are. There's about 500 individual species. This is the only one, and we've checked with our botanist friends and assured other greenhouse people that have inquired that this and only this is identified in the bill is the one that produces this hallucinogenic effects, psychotropic effects.
Okay, thank you. Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dave, thanks for your presentation. I guess I would say that my parental sensors go up when I hear this. I've never heard of salvia before. My assumption that my neighbors that have kids would agree in this sense, that we don't need the proliferation of, we have enough difficulties in our society without the proliferation that this potentially represents. There are provisions for its use that may or may not be legitimate, but let's just at the point say that people can legally have access to it if they need it, and that our kids do not need expanded opportunities to be able to grade their capacity, be it in school or be it in normal life, because we have enough challenges. So I'm very supportive of this bill, and with that, I move the CS for Senate Bill 313 be moved from committee with zero physical note, individual comments.
Is there objection? Hearing none, this bill's moved to its next committee of referral. Let's take a short recess. back on the record. Next, we're going to look at Senate Bill 48. We have the sponsor, Senator Davis, with us here this morning. Welcome to the Judiciary Committee, Senator Davis. Would you like a glass of ice water?
I think I would. And seriously, I do need some water. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Senator French. Now, French, that's not an American name.
Uh-oh.
Just reliving some of the skit. Thank you.
Seriously.
Welcome, Senator Senator
thank
Davis.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for hearing my bill, and I'm very pleased that it's going to come up today because I've been working on it for, you know, last year and this year, and I hope I can get it over to the House. So I appreciate your consideration. And I just want to commend you on all the work that the Judiciary Committee has been doing. I've been watching you guys on television and trying to keep up with what's going on. And I know that you've been very busy, but I know you've been keeping up with your work. And I think this is a good bill, and it's worthy of hearing. And I think it would be a benefit to the state. There are many states that have passed such a law as this, and it's working quite well for them. And so I'm anxious to get this one moving towards the House so that it may pass this year. And Richard is here with me, my aide, and he's going to introduce the bill to you. And I think you have a package of material, and we'll just move on from there.
Richard, if you'll introduce yourself for the record, we're eager to hear your introduction this morning.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Richard Benavides. I'm staff for Senator Davis here, who is the sponsor of Senate Bill 48. In its simplest terms, this bill basically states that a public school may not deny any student access to programs or services simply because the parent of the student has refused to place that student on psychotropic medications, get a psychiatric evaluation, or seek psychiatric or psychological treatment for a child. It also spells out what communications are allowed, who can do evaluations, and the protections a parent or guardian has against being reported to OCS simply because they disagree with psychotropic medications. We've been working on this bill for several years, and we recognize that psychotropic medications are one of the many treatment interventions that may be used to address mental health problems, and many times medication may be recommended and prescribed for children with mental, behavioral, or emotional symptoms when the potential benefits for treatment outweigh the risks. Now, the U.S. Department of Education has clearly informed educators that medical professionals, not education professionals, are responsible for prescribing this type of medication. However, the role of educators in providing information about a student's behavior is also recognized as being an aid to making any type of diagnosis. And in the 2004 reauthorization of the IDEA law, that requires that each state prohibit any state or school district personnel from requiring that a child has to obtain a prescription for a substance covered by the Controlled Substance Act, which would be a psychotropic, as a condition of attending school, receiving any type of services, or receiving an evaluation for a disability. Now, this prohibition does not prevent teachers or other school personnel from consulting or sharing classroom-based observations with parents or guardians about a student's academic and functional performance or their behavior in the classroom or school, or the need for an evaluation for special education or any kind of related services. So what we've done here, we've adopted that stance in Senate Bill 48 that in order to clarify that public school teachers and school district personnel may share those observations with a parent and may offer program options and other assistance to the parent, but they still may not compel any specific action by the parent or require that a student take medication. So essentially, Senator Davis feels that any medical decision made to address a student's need is a matter between the student's parent, and a competent health care professional chosen by the parent. As in past versions, nothing in this particular version of the bill precludes school personnel from using any other means of dealing with any behavioral problems, such as putting together a plan or having, you know, you can't go on this field trip because you didn't reach this particular level, things of that nature. So we feel that this particular bill is only targeting the one aspect of not allowing teachers, if you will, to say little Johnny can't come into my classroom unless he is on some sort of medication. The teacher can certainly say to the parent, you know, little Johnny's been pretty disruptive, maybe you should have him evaluated. So those kind of things are still allowable in the bill, whereas the specific mention of, hey, you need to see Dr. X or you need to do prescription X that's the type of thing that's prohibited in the bill. So if you have any other questions, I believe there's people online. Also, I've tried to call people, but it's kind of been a moving target. So hopefully we still have some people.
Okay, questions for the sponsor? Seeing none, we will go then to some of the people that are online, and we'll start from the log cabins of the Mat Su, as Senator Huggins says, with Stuart Thompson. Stuart, are you there?
Yes, I am, sir.
If you'll introduce yourself to the members, sir, we're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
Very well. My name is Stuart Thompson. I'm a citizen of Wasilla. My remarks are prepared, but they take 4 minutes. May I proceed?
Yes, and if you go ahead, but okay. Keep it as brief as you can, sir.
I can. I'll even speak fast. I'm testifying in support of SB 48 passage. The aspect of the bill most relevant to your committee is that it just enforces occupational competence for the public good, the essence of occupational licensing. Government always gets a bad name when it isn't consistent in its regulation of businesses and professions. Occupational licensing is the government device to ensure a minimum level of competence in people practicing a craft on the public. The public understands the legitimacy of such regulation and the state bureaucracy to implement it. The conceptual flag for this is the public conviction that it's bad for people to practice medicine without a license. This bill makes a plain attempt to channel parents to people trained to give professional level service and advice. It should be obvious that teacher and school administrator training is not designed to make such people competent to practice medicine, psychology, psychiatry, or spiritual counseling. I wish to focus my testimony on why what is seemingly common sense needs specific law to enforce it. What we are facing is dramatization of the greatest collective failure humanity has, an incompetent ability to understand human behavior. This manifests in the almost universal fear of human irrationality, minimally psychological disorders like what's called attention deficit, and its extreme form, madness. People who are afraid naturally grasp at anything to settle confusions and threats caused by what they fear. Naturally, faced with inexplicable behavior of children, parents and others grasp advice from nearly any source they conceive to have repute. Thus, heavy pharmaceutical marketing and advertisements pushing the apparently scientific idea that man is a chemically motivated stimulus response animal exerts tremendous influence. A vacuum of understanding is filled with the alluring concept that Johnny's mental problems are caused just by chemical imbalances that are treatable by drugs. This directly tempts one of humanity's most dangerous weaknesses, lust for shortcuts. This lust has been preyed on since the days of snake oil salesmen and granny love potions, the progenitors of modern pharmaceutical companies. So out of fear, inadequate understandings, and lust for shortcuts, we have the source of child over-medication. The abuse of legal drugs and the over-medication of children should concern you almost more than any other form of substance abuse. Why? Because once a child or youth becomes convinced through adult or social encouragement that drugs are the simplest answer to becoming normal or happier, he's primed to explore illegal drugs using the same justification. Legal pronouncements hardly impress those already rebelling against robotically enforced authority. That's why I am enraged that government has been snookered into permitting and even worse, indirectly subsidizing the promotion of what is rationalizing substance abuse. And this is while sanctimoniously waging a war against it. Indeed, just 2 days ago, the Washington Post published an article, experts defining mental disorders are linked to drug firms. The LAO here can fax you a copy. We're talking about the virtual basis of logical thinking, identification of causes and their effects. I don't ask you to blindly agree with me. Don't just depend on the scientifically weak psychological experts who've replaced the tractability treatment fads of beatings, electroconvulsive therapy, and lobotomies with a fresh fad of psychotropic drugs. I ask you to use your own minds about what's at stake. Passing SB 48 creates a decent posterity greater than you know. Give yourself the honor of doing so. That's it on my testimony.
Any questions for Mr. Thompson? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony this morning. Next from Mat-Su, is it Margaret Anthony?
Margaret Mark Anthony.
Thank you, Margaret. Welcome to the Judiciary Committee. If you'll introduce yourself to the members, we're eager to hear your testimony.
All right. Jean Terrio knows me as Meg Carney. I got married and got a new last name. So anyway, hi, Jean.
All right.
All right. I'm a parent. I'm a rentals manager. I got a BA in psychology at UAF in 1983, and I'm a spiritual counselor practicing non-traditional mental health. I'm very concerned about the rampant drugging of children in this country. Several years ago, we had more than 8 million kids in this country alone on psychotropic drugs. I believe parents are not always truly informed on the risks of these drugs, and when you're hearing it from all sides about how they ought to be using them, I think that they're hearing it from the school system. It's like Stuart said, they're going to have a tendency to blindly go along with it, perhaps, as a quick fix, not knowing any better. I think that drug use and things of this nature should be between the parent and the doctor, and I don't think the school system should be involved in it, and I don't think that anybody in the school system should be pushing anybody in that direction. One of my concerns is that I really believe that these drugs have long-term effects that society isn't really aware of. I think some of our most talented people in history had trouble sitting still in school or didn't get good grades, and one of these is Albert Einstein. He got very poor grades and was staring out the window wishing he was somewhere else. Tom Cruise, an actor, Jim Carrey was an actor. Both of these guys are talented, have lots of energy, they're brilliant people, and they had a heck of a time sitting still in school. And I think that sometimes people like that are going to have a tendency to be labeled as ADD or ADHD because somebody wants to get them to sit still. And I think it was just a stroke of luck that Tom Cruise's mother didn't go along with what they were recommending when he was a boy. So anyway, I think that in this day and age, even probably Albert Einstein would have been stuck on those drugs. And who knows, we might not have had all the brilliant, genius things that he came up with. So I think that we have to be real careful about putting these people on these drugs. Even our own military knows that people don't quite turn out right after being on these drugs for any length of time, because anybody who's been on Ritalin for more than a couple of years as a kid is not ever eligible to serve in the military. I think we're having a hard enough time recruiting from the military already without having high numbers of people ineligible for reasons of drug use. Another issue is that people who are on these drugs have a higher risk of suicide and crazy behavior, and it's showing up more and more over time. This Columbine High School thing a couple of years ago was a kid who was on those types of drugs, and there's a very, very strong connection between this, what I call psych drugs, and these crazy shooting sprees, and whether the person who was taking them, not taking them when they had been, or stopped, or forgot to take them a couple of days, whatever, these drugs appear to interfere with people's good judgment and moral aptitude. And I think that I realize that experts tout them as a fix-all, but I believe they're overused in our society, and rampant use of them in children is completely inappropriate and should be discouraged overall. Certainly not sold, quote-unquote, to parents and children in any way through the public school system. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Terrio.
Thank you. Meg just wanted to say hello back to you and ask a quick question. Did I see your brother on the TV last night? Is he got the potato chip company in Mat-Su?
Yep, that's my little brother, Ralph.
Okay. I thought so. Well, good to hear from you.
Anybody, yeah, thank you.
Anybody named Ralph is okay with me. Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony this morning, Margaret. Let's go next to Fairbanks, Frank Turney. Frank, are you with us this morning?
Yes. Can you hear me?
We can hear you, sir. And if you'll introduce yourself to the members, we're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
I'm Frank Turney. I'm a community activist. I've been concerned about this issue for the past two decades. And Senator Seekins and Terry, all members of the judiciary. First of all, I'd like to thank Senator Betty Davis and Chief of Staff Richard Benavides for bringing this important bill forward, which would prohibit school personnel from recommending or requiring prescriptions, psychotropic drugs, evaluations, or recommending a certain physician. I sent you a copy of a resolution number 2005 passed last year by the Borough Assembly on April 14th, introduced by former Assemblyman Bonnie Williams in support of legislation which addresses the issue before us. Also, a recent resolution, number 4208, introduced by City Councilman Lloyd Hilling on April 10th of this year, passed the City Council. Also, I included a letter from Senator Lisa Murkowski regarding a federal law prohibition on mandatory medication. You know, the information that I've received in research that many parents are concerned about children being misdiagnosed with ADD or ADHD and denied the opportunity to perform in military service, and resolution number 4208 that was by City Councilman Helen mentions that in whereas, in the third whereas, potential recruits are ineligible for military service. They have taken such a drug in previous year, and such recruits may be ineligible due to childhood use. And also another concern is one of the other individuals' testimony regarding overdose, suicide, serious heart problems, and death caused by Ritalin and other psychotropic drugs. And also City Councilman Hilling also in the fourth whereas such drug poses a significant risk of multitude of proven negative side effects, including negative transformation of personality and even death. And I encourage you to go to www.redlanddeath.com. It's a website that needs to be looked at, and I encourage you to take a look at that website. And also, I recommend it that Dr. Peter Brigham is one of the most foremost psychiatrists in the country. He's the author of the book, Talking Back at Ritalin. And all the research and data coming from experts in this field working with children that are taking antidepressant medication. And the studies that I found indicate the stepping stone has been a teacher or school personnel suggesting to a parent that little Johnny might need a ADD evaluation or might need Ritalin to control his behavior. Or I might know a certain doctor that little Johnny can go to. I believe there needs to be a state law, children in stone, to make sure parents and most of all children are protected from being coerced into medicating their children or taking evaluation. And also I'd like to indicate that when you look at Ritalin, you can go to any website and look at Ritalin and DEA. The Drug Enforcement Agency is Ritalin is Schedule II drug because of its dependence and addiction. I know on the street corner, a speedball is heroin and cocaine mixed. A poor man's speedball is heroin and Ritalin mixed, the same euphoria and the same high. So when we're dealing with these drugs like Ritalin and other antidepressant drugs, it's like a bingo game. Sometimes you win and sometimes you lose. And so I really believe this Senate Bill 48 will help prevention. As far as psychologists and psychiatrists in school, I don't know. When I went to school, we didn't have psychologists and we didn't have Ritalin to give the kids. Maybe we should bring back corporal punishment. I remember when I acted up in the classroom, our teacher took us down in the classroom with about a 2-inch paddle with holes in it, and you sit down and you got 4 or 5 whacks. Or you went down to the played a little basketball, run around the baseball diamond. Well, like, you can't do that anymore in our schools. So I'd like to get back to the old days myself personally. But I would hope that you would seriously take a look at both these resolutions were passed by the North Star Borough, and also the resolution was passed recently by Lloyd Hilling, who is an economic professor and also teaches middle school. So he's had his experience on these kids from coming and going. He don't know, sometimes they're passive, sometimes they're on like they're on speed. So I think we have a serious problem. And like I say, of all the research I have, the stepping stone is coming from a school teacher or school personnel suggesting to a mother that a child needs an evaluation. And I believe that this bill will prevent that from happening. And I think this is a start in the right direction. And I want to thank Richard Benavides and Senator Betty Davis for having patience with me here over the past 2 or 3 years on this bill. And thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Turney? Seeing none, thank you, Frank, for testifying this morning.
Thank you.
Let's go next to Anchorage to Greg Sternquist. Greg, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
We can hear you, sir, and if you'll introduce yourself to the committee, we're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
You bet. Good morning, Senator. This is the first time I've ever testified, so it's kind of a new experience for me. My name is Greg Sternquist. I'm a practicing chiropractor here in Anchorage. I'm affiliated with the Citizens Commission on Human Rights. I've been treating parents, teachers, children, and been listening to their problems dealing with ADHD, learning behaviors for many years now. I do give public presentations quite frequently on information that's been brought to bear and brought to the public about ADHD and learning behaviors. So I kind of consider myself a bit of an expert on this. I think this is an incredible bill that they have up. It's kind of hard to follow such great testimonies. But one of the things that I do know is much of the data, you know, the teachers are trying out there. They really do care about the students. But most of the data they're getting is brought to bear by, brought to them by companies such, or organizations such as CHAD and other pharmaceutically based funded agencies. So when it comes time to deciding what to do with these children, they don't have all the information out there. There are many, many causes for children's behavior, most of them physical. There are other reasons for this other than simply give them a drug. So I just wanted to let you know I'm in favor of this bill. It's an incredible way to give the responsibility and the rights back to the parent. And I can answer any questions. There it is.
Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Sternquist, for your testimony this morning. We appreciate it. And for the first time, you did very well.
Well, thank you very much.
Let's move next to the off-nets, Angela Tillery. Angela, are you with us this morning?
Good morning. Yes, I am.
Good morning. And if you'll introduce yourself to the members, we're eager to hear your testimony.
Hi, my name is Angela Tillery, and I am a director with the Church of Scientology. Would you like me to just go ahead?
Go right ahead, ma'am. Thank you.
All right. Well, I'm calling to testify as to my own personal experience in counseling parents whose children have been recommended by the school district to get an evaluation. To start with, I want to say that I strongly agree with most everybody that you have already heard. I've been listening in the entire time. I have experienced parents that have come to me going, what do I do? My child is in preschool in the school district. My child's 4 years old and they're recommending that we put our child on Ritalin or some other kind of drug because my child is, you know, so hyper all the time. You know, but nobody has recommended that they go and explore all of the options out there for their child. They haven't gone to explore, does the child have food allergies? Does the child have vitamin deficiencies? Is the child having, you know, problems with study? Is there any other reason? You know, they just want a quick fix in the school district because, you know, they have 20, 30, sometimes even more children in one classroom and they, you know, want it to be easily controlled. So, you know, I am strongly in favor of this bill, and I would love to see this passed so that parents are able to make their own decisions about what is the best thing for their child. And, you know, it's not put in the hands of a educator who makes the recommendation that they take the child to a doctor, and the doctor is taking that information and saying, well, the educator needs this. And there's no kind of actual physical tests that we can do, no blood tests, no urine tests that we can do to say, oh, well, this child has ADD or ADHD, so let's put them on this miracle cure. There is no test for it. You know, they just take a group of, you know, symptomatic behaviors and say, oh, well, maybe this is the drug for them. Maybe it's not. You know, in my experience with children of any age, whatever the child's problem is, it is not that the parents have not given them enough drugs in their lifetime. So with that, I just want to say that I am fully in support of this bill.
Any questions for Ms. Tillery? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony this morning.
You're welcome.
And let's move next to Richard Warner. Mr. Warner, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Thank you. And if you'll welcome to the Judiciary Committee, and if you'll introduce yourself to the members, we're eager to hear what your testimony is this morning.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Richard Warner. I'm the president of the Seattle chapter of the Citizens Commission on Human Rights. The Citizens Commission on Human Rights is sort of an international watchdog group over the field of psychiatry and mental health. And we've been pushing for many years for the passage of such legislation, and we support it. It has been passed in a number of similar legislation has been passed in a number of states including Connecticut, Minnesota, Illinois, Virginia, Colorado, Arizona, New Hampshire, and Florida. You know, kids face enormous difficulties growing up in today's society, and there are dozens of root causes that we can point to which influence their development and behavior. They include unwanted births, divorce, broken homes, hours spent in front of television sets, constant exposure in our society from a very young age to sexual images, poor nutrition, poor overall health, poverty, drug abuse, exposure to environmental toxins, simply a lack of adult guidance in their lives. I'm sure all of you can add your own factors to this list. Now, the psychiatrist walks in and he says, well, you know what the problem is? The kid's defective. He's got a bad brain. And he sort of disconnects the condition of the child from the root causes of what's going on in that child's life. The problem, of course, is that there's no evidence whatsoever that there's anything wrong with the brain of the child. In fact, for mental illness in general, there's no evidence that it's produced by any sort of chemical imbalance or defect in a person's brain. The Surgeon General's 1999 report on mental health said there's no definitive lesion, laboratory test, or abnormality in brain tissue that can identify the illness, referring to mental illness. Harvard psychiatrist Joseph Glenn Mullen has said, in recent decades, we have no shortage of alleged biochemical imbalances for psychiatric conditions. Diligent though these attempts have been, not one has been proven. Quite the contrary, in every instance where such an imbalance was thought to have been found, it was later proven false. And of course, they don't even have a test that can determine the chemical status of a person's brain. So, this whole idea that there's something wrong with these kids' brains, that there's a medical problem here, is simply public relations. It's an expedient way of selling drugs, but there's no scientific or medical proof that this is actually the case. Now, the other problem, of course, is the drugs themselves. So the FDA has recently, over the last several months, issued an unprecedented series of warnings about psychiatric drugs. They found that antidepressants can at least double the risk of a child becoming suicidal. They found that ADHD drugs like Ritalin can increase the risk of cardiovascular problems. They found that drugs like Ritalin and methylphenidate and these sort of ADHD drugs can lead to suicidal ideation, hallucinations, aggression, violent psychotic behavior. And believe me, we're just touching the surface of what's being discovered about the many effects. Almost every month, there's something coming out in the journal talking about new effects that we're finding, effects on fetuses, effects from pregnant women taking these drugs during pregnancy. They just have tremendous effects that are being discovered every day. And of course, they're not effective either. That's the other thing. Washington Post, April 18, 2004, reported that of the 15 trials conducted among depressed children, 10 failed to show antidepressants were better than dummy pills, placebo. Two were inconclusive, three showed positive results, but two of those three, an internal FDA analysis of those two studies showed that the evidence for efficacy is not convincing. So, what do we have? We end up having millions of kids putting on drugs with no medical basis for that being done, with study after study showing that the drugs are not only ineffective, but tremendously dangerous. Now, this bill, the previous version of this bill, the only problem I have with the current bill is that the previous version was much stronger. The previous version recognized that there's a lack of a medical basis for labeling children as having brain disease or chemical imbalances, and recognized that given the enormous risks of these drugs and their complete lack of effectiveness, no one, particularly the state, has any business forcing or coercing parents to have their kids psychiatrically evaluated or psychiatrically drugged. And the previous version of this bill essentially stopped school personnel and courts from going after parents who don't want their kids psychiatrically tested and drugged. Now, recently, this bill was revised to allow school personnel and courts to go after parents who do not consent by accusing them of mental injury or neglect. And mental injury is defined in your statute as an injury to the emotional well-being or intellectual or psychological capacity of a child, as evidenced by observable and substantial impairment in the child's ability to function. Neglect is defined as the failure by a person responsible for the child's welfare to provide necessary food, care, clothing, shelter, or medical attention. I stress that, medical attention for a child. Well, who's going to be deciding whether there's mental injury or neglect? It's going to be the very people who think kids have bad brains. It's going to be the very people that we're trying to protect parents from. So I would say this legislation is certainly a step in the right direction, and we support it, but I think you could do much better. I think we could strengthen this so that we really protect parents from the state coming down and saying, you're failing to provide medical attention for your child because you're not agreeing to put your child on an antidepressant that not only is not effective, but has been determined by the FDA to double their suicidal risk and possibly cause cardiovascular conditions. I think there's a way we can take care of any concerns people might have about kids not getting really necessary medical attention. And the bill already contains stuff that keeps in place the ability of school personnel to report obvious cases of abuse and neglect of children. That's not a problem. But I do see a problem with the bill allowing school personnel now to go after parents again and get a court order to force the parents to put their kids on drugs. And I don't think that's a good thing. So I would suggest that that's an area that the bill can be improved. That's about it. I'd be happy to answer any questions anyone might have.
Questions for Mr. Warner? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony this morning, Mr. Warner.
Thank you, sir.
We also have, to answer any questions, Jean Michelle from Legal Services and Barbara Thompson from EED. Any questions for the sponsor or for either of those folks today from members? Senator Huggins?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Davis, the last speaker talked about watering down the bill, and he was concerned. Do you share his concern?
No, I don't. I wouldn't be presenting the bill if I thought I had a problem with it. We have presented another version of this bill, and working with the people in order to bring them aboard, there was a new CS that was prepared less than a month ago.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. Any other questions? Do we have anyone in the audience that wished to testify this morning? Have anyone else online? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony on the bill. Questions or discussion from the members?
You don't have to.
Senator Guess.
No, I'm glad that it is in front of us. I think it's an important issue, and it's important to put as much control back to parents as possible. And with that, I will move Senate Bill CS for Senate Bill 48 out of committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Hearing none, this bill is moved to its next committee of referral. Thank you very much, Senator Davis, for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
We'll take a short recess to do the paperwork. We're back on the record. I have before us this morning House Bill 446. The sponsor is Representative McGuire, and we have staff from McGuire here. Good morning.
Morning, sir.
And if you'll introduce yourself for the record, we're eager to hear your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Craig Johnson. I am staff to Representative Lisa McGuire. Before you today is HB 446, and before I really get started, I'd like to take everyone back to 1976 and think where we were. First barrel of oil was coming down the pipeline. I was in college, and we can all think about where we were, but there are also some ladies and gentlemen in this room enacting the very first consumer protection bill in the state of Alaska, maybe in this very same room with very good intentions. And on when they did that, they instituted the fines that were applicable, and those fines are in effect today. There's been over 400% inflation. A dollar, a 1976 dollar, would be less worth less than a penny today. So that's really what we're here to do. Last year, the Federal Trade Commission said that the state of Alaska led the nation in consumer protection complaints. This bill basically puts teeth in the consumer protection laws, bringing them basically up to inflation, allowing them to have penalties. This bill has had no opposition to this point. I have no one to testify online. I do have Ed Sniffen here to answer questions with the Department of Law, and also Ted Popley, who is legal counsel for Ledge Counsel, so he's counsel's counsel, to answer any questions that might be of a legal nature that might pop up that I would be unable to answer. And with that, sir, I will turn it over to the committee.
Okay. Questions for Craig? Senator French.
It looks to me like this simply updates the amounts of the fines, doesn't change any substantive law, doesn't change any rights or remedies. It just says these are the new values we can get for violations of consumer rights.
That's correct, sir.
Thank you.
Other questions? Hearing none, we have Ed Sniffen online. Good morning, Ed.
Yes, Senator Deacon, thank you.
If you'll introduce yourself once again to the members of the committee, we're eager to hear your analysis here.
Thank you. My name is Ed Smith, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law, and my responsibilities include enforcement of the Consumer Protection Act, which this bill would amend, and I really have nothing to add to the statement made by the bill sponsor. This really is an update to our law to bring our fines more in line with modern penalties that are assessed by other states. There are some states that actually have fines in the $100,000 range. There are also states that have fines a little lower than Alaska's, but the majority of states clearly have fines in excess of what our current statute provides. And so this would allow us to bring our statute more in line with modern practice. And I want to know for the committee as well that these fines are only assessed by the state of Alaska in our enforcement actions. Private individuals are unable to seek these kinds of fines against businesses for consumer protection actions. It would be something only the state would do. We would still retain the authority to settle cases, of course, for amounts less than these fines, which we do on a regular basis. But it does, as the sponsor suggests, updates our fine amount. Almost exactly with the cost of inflation since the time this bill was originally passed in the 1970s. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions anyone has. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Sniffen? Ed, this is Senator Seekins. I'm assuming, as I look at the bill under on page 1, line 6, a person who violates the terms of an injunction or restraining order, I'm assuming that where there's an implied knowingly and willfully in there. Am I correct?
Senator Seegers, you are correct.
I know that's always there in terms of our law, but it's not always clear to the average person who's reading the law.
Senator Seegers, I think that's correct. We have, I think, a number of statutes on our books that have that same effect, and I know in the 6 years I've been enforcing our Consumer Protection Act where this Section A issue has come up, we have always treated that as a knowing or willful violation of a restraining order or an injunction before those types of penalties are imposed. And as far as I know, we have never had to do that.
Okay. And also, in paragraph, subparagraph B, would we assume that there, if the court finds that a person is knowingly and willfully using an or has acted, used an act knowingly and willfully, that...
Senator Zekins, the test used by the court really depends on the conduct and the allegations made in the case when it comes to assessing fines. For example, you can commit an unfair trade practice by engaging in conduct that has the likelihood of causing deception. So if you are found by the court to have engaged in that conduct, you don't necessarily need to willfully have committed some kind of actual deception on a consumer, but you have simply may have engaged in conduct that creates a likelihood of confusion surrounding the sale of goods or services. What subsection B here, and it currently is our law, says that if the court finds that you have violated our Consumer Protection Act, then the court can establish the appropriate penalty.
And what standard would you use to bring the action, to bring someone to the court?
Chairman Zekins, we look at a variety of factors in every individual case when we decide whether or not to bring an action against someone, and it's our policy now that we consider the impacts of the conduct on Alaska and its residents, and if there is a significant impact on the public interest, we feel it's our duty to go forward with an action, you know, against a business or an individual who may be violating our Consumer Protection Act. There are cases involving more private disputes between individuals that really are unique just to that individual and to that one business, and if we aren't aware of a pattern or practice of unfair behavior that business is engaging in that could affect a broader public interest, we're unlikely to spend resources pursuing those types of matters. So we really do focus our efforts on bigger picture, if you will, violations that have a significant impact on Alaska and its residents.
Is it your normal practice, and when you run into something like that, that you would say to the person, you know, this act or practice is unlawful, and you need to stop it and cease and desist?
Chairman Zekins, that is correct. We oftentimes enter into informal agreements or understandings with businesses and consumers as well that. You may not have known this was a violation of the law, but now you know we don't see a lot of harm. You know, correct the harm that's been done and promise us that you won't do it again. And we do have a mechanism in our consumer protection law that allows us to enter what we call an assurance of voluntary compliance with a business. And that assurance is essentially an agreement with the business that they will not engage in the conduct in the future. And we can file those with the court, and the court can approve them. They can't be used later in a court action as evidence you did anything wrong. It's more of a good faith attempt on behalf of our department and the business to recognize that there's some conduct here that should be stopped, but it's not serious enough that we think penalties are warranted or that we need to go to court over it. And we informally resolve those.
Okay. Other questions for Mr. Sniffen? Seeing none, Ed, thank you for coming out on a Saturday and testifying for us.
Yes, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Any other questions for the sponsor? Seeing none, is there anyone else that wants to testify on this bill this morning? No one online? Anyone in the audience? Public testimony is closed on the bill. Discussion by the members. Senator, yes.
I'll move CS for House Bill 446 out of committee with individual recommendations in the attached fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Hearing none, this bill is moved on to its next committee referral. Thank you, Craig, for being with us this morning.
Thank you, sir.
Short recess. Does. We're back on the record. No.
No?
We're now going to move to Senate Bill 316. And the intent here today is to discuss proposed language that we can look at to try to move forward. And if we can come to some reasonable agreement on the language, what we'll do is then ask that a CS be prepared that we would look at again next Tuesday at our, when we come back. So it gives you an idea of, we're not trying to move this bill out of here today, but we are trying to do some constructive work on it. The draft that I've put out there is for the justice to take some consideration of the language is an attempt to try to allow the legislature to go forward with consideration of the contract and allow the someone to be able to challenge the findings and determinations that the legislature relied upon, provided that the legislature actually approves or authorizes the signing of the execution of a contract. What, as I read the original bill that came out, the challenge could be made at the point where the decision was made to execute the contract. Until there was an actual action to somehow or another authorize a contract, there was nothing that was ripe for consideration by the courts in terms of how it was reached. It appears to me that what we're trying to do is do the same thing, saying once we have interjected ourselves in the process, the legislature did, so it just puts one more step into the process before there can be a judicial review. The average guy living in a log cabin in Wasilla is not going to use a challenge to the findings or the determinations unjustly, in my opinion. I think that person would legitimately look at whether or not, or try to determine whether or not the contract was in the best fiscal interest of the state. The only party that could possibly use it unjustly if we leave the challenge to be in the middle of the process would be someone who wanted to high center the process for political or for private reasons, but I don't believe we should allow. We should allow that challenge to occur at the end of the process, just like it is now. And that means we delay that until there has been legislative consideration and legislative authorization. I don't think we've removed anything from the process. So, I also am very concerned as I looked at the bill, and I think all of us have discussed this, that there's plenty of opportunity for everyone to be able to examine the supporting body of evidence that led the commissioner to his preliminary findings. All that body of evidence becomes public at the moment that the commissioner releases those preliminary findings. For an example, right now, the commissioner has not released any preliminary findings at all, so therefore it appears to me that all the body of evidence, even the contract that's under consideration, is not yet a public document. But as soon as those preliminary findings are published, it all becomes public, except for that proprietary information that's identified in Section 310. So that being financial data, et cetera, from some of the companies that are parties to the contract.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
On that point, I think there's also a category of documents that were part of the deliberative process that can also be withheld. Now, it's my understanding the administration up to this point has been trying to put together a system where they are separating documents sort of as they go, you know, in different piles, which will, you know, be released. And they're trying to have the ones that are released be the biggest pile by far. But there, I just wanted to state that there is a category of documents that are part of them deliberating. Language that's in transition, sort of, that might not be available to the public.
My concern is that every document that would be discoverable in a legal action or a legal challenge should be made public at that particular time. Now, so there are a couple words in there in 430, and if we look at 430,
as it stands now.
Well, I mean, so let me go back. I'm sorry, 410. On line 8.
I'm sorry, line 8 of
page 21.
This is the act.
Oh, the act itself, the current act.
Mine isn't numbered.
Yeah, mine's not. Oh.
Oh, this is the okay. I know what document.
Of the current act.
Okay.
Right. Which is the current act. There's one word there on line 8 called supporting financial documents, technical data, which could be, you know, in my mind interpreted that only those documents that support my position need to be disclosed. You notice in the draft of the conversation that we have, the term supporting has been eliminated in the draft that I want us to consider. And here is a current draft of that, by the way.
This makes it more open.
Is the one you're handing out different than the one we
got yesterday? Yeah, a little bit different. There's one extra. There's about half a dozen extra words. I'll point them out to you. If you look at the on page 1 of what we're looking at in discussion, it says toward the fourth line up from the bottom, it says that the commissioner shall submit the commissioner's final findings and determinations and the financial, technical, and market data, etc., including work papers that were considered by the commissioner to make the final findings and determinations to the legislature. So it broadens it, in my opinion, by eliminating the word supporting.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, remind me again. I'm on your new draft.
Yeah.
I'm on the new draft.
The bottom of the page, the fourth line up.
Subparagraph
435B1 in that paragraph. The question that comes up is, under the current language of the bill, the commissioner would only have to provide that information that supported his decision. Mm-hmm. Am I correct or not? Senator French?
I think there are clearly two definitions of the word support, and I think a government lawyer would lose in a heartbeat trying to argue to a judge that the only documents that get released are the documents that favor my side in the sense of support, and that a judge would construe the statute against the government.
I want to make sure that we don't have a lawyer's playground.
Well,
as much as we can.
Again, I think, you know, every word is subject, every single word we write down is subject to contrasting interpretations. And I appreciate the impulse, and I don't disagree with the impulse. The impulse is for more openness, and so I think that's commendable. But I, from my own view, find it anyway unlikely that the word supporting would be used against a litigant.
Well, I really want to make sure on this very important decision that there is a level of transparency and inclusion, and not the opportunity for someone to exclude.
If I may, just by the same token, on the second to last line on that page, there's the word, you know, all these documents, the work papers, analyses, recommendations that were considered by the commissioner, you know, a clever lawyer, a clever government lawyer, I guess, could stand up and say, oh, this whole vault of information that we've assembled, that wasn't considered by the commissioner. He decided not to consider it. And again, I think that would be brushed aside by a judge who would never let that stop the release of documents if they were collected, assembled, and somehow, you know, analyzed by anyone within the administration as they were funneled towards a commissioner in his analysis of the project.
But I think we can only hold the commissioner responsible for those things that the commissioner himself in his findings actually considered.
And see, and I don't know the answer to that. That's why, you know, the term of art that the government, the administration, Mr. Ostrowski told us about was final finding and determination. That's a term of art that sort of works in the legal community to sort of signify the place where you can bring a challenge, and then you go off and begin your search for documents through the process of discovery.
And discovery, as you know, is always a contentious matter anyhow. This was not a discoverable document. Well, yes, it was. Well, we'll let the judge decide.
So the judge decides yes or no, and there you go.
Yep. So what we're attempting to do here, though, is to make this as clear and as transparent as possible, allow someone after the preliminary notice to examine the body of documents, if they believe something isn't there that should be there, to shine the light on it, give the commissioner the opportunity in that process to produce those documents, come up with a final compilation with his final findings and determination, and at that point the legislature goes to work. At the legislative level, it then becomes the responsibility of the legislature to put themselves pretty much in the same category as the commissioner in examining whether or not the body of evidence supports the finding of best long-term fiscal interest of the state, making that decision, then allowing that decision based on the findings and the determinations to be challenged. Mm-hmm. Not an easy thing. It's never been done before. But so this is just, I have, and the next question then is, under judicial review on page 2, paragraph 440, that a judicial review based on a final determination would have to be filed within 30 days under the Administrative Procedures Act or Rule 602. Now, a constitutional challenge in our current act is given 120 days to challenge it based on a constitutional basis. I've left it blank. What is a reasonable time to bring the challenge? Senator Terrio?
It would seem to me if you're going to have one, the Constitution that goes 120 days, there's, I don't know that there's harm on allowing the other one in 120 days.
I don't think. I think they both should be the same time frame.
Yep. Yeah.
However, what do you want? 120, 90, 60, 30, 12? Where do we want to go?
I'm comfortable with 120.
Yeah.
Everybody pretty comfortable with that? I didn't want to make that decision all by myself. Okay, so we're looking at 120 days. We'll just write that into that little blank spot there for now.
That's in fact status quo.
That's on a constitutional challenge. It adds 90 more days to a challenge to a final decision.
So it makes it more permissive.
It makes it more permissive. So you can.
I'm guessing that any challenge would probably be challenging on both. So what it would have is one document versus two on different timelines. So
more than likely.
More efficient.
More than likely, a challenge on the findings would constitute a constitutional challenge because it wasn't in the best fiscal interest of the state. So.
Except, Mr. Chairman, also, a challenge on findings can be a process, too.
Right.
I mean, when you're challenging an agency's decision, you can challenge on process.
Well, and the process was, it still could be a constitutional issue because you didn't follow the process to really come up with a true finding.
Right.
Yeah.
Or the person's process rights were abridged.
Right.
That's constitutional. You're right.
So are we kind of in agreement on the steps that we want to go through? That's the question. We want to make sure at the preliminary finding, and I'm convinced that the body of documents, the body of evidence that the commissioner used to determine, come up with his preliminary findings, is made public at the point that the preliminary findings are signed and published. Then there's a period of time for the public and legislative review. Then next, after the end of the public review, the commissioner.
And just for clarity, that's we think somewhere between 30 and 60 days.
It's at least 30 days.
At least 30 instead.
Right. It's at least 30 days. It can't be shut down any.
Nothing less than 30.
Nothing less than 30.
Might be up to 60.
Yeah.
Could be.
Then
beyond that. But.
Right. Then the commissioner closes off public comment. And then within 30 days after that, the commissioner has to gather everything together, prepare a summary of the public comment, legislative comment, put all that body together, and then bring the findings that are required to the legislature or to the governor along with the contract. The governor then has the option of forwarding that to the legislature. So we've included in the language that not just the contract would be required to come to the legislature, but the entire body of evidence that they used to craft the final determinations, findings and determinations, which then the legislature.
Could we just stop on that? Are we operating at 4:30 now?
We're in 4:30 under the new draft.
Under the new draft.
Right. Let's go there. 4:30 A. Within 30 days after the close of the public comment period, the Commissioner of Revenue shall prepare a summary of the public comments received in response to the proposed contract and the preliminary findings and determination. Two, after consultation with the Commissioner of Natural Resources, if appropriate, and with the pertinent municipal advisory group established under AS 4382-510, prepare a list of proposed amendments, if any, to the proposed contract that the Commissioner of Revenue determines are necessary to respond to public comments. Three, then make final findings and determination as to whether the proposed contract and any proposed amendments prepared under two of this subsection meet the requirements and purposes of the chapter. Then it goes to B. After considering the material described in A and securing the agreement of the other parties to the proposed contract regarding any proposed amendments prepared under A of this section, if the commissioner determines that the contract is in the long-term fiscal interest of the state, commissioner shall submit the contract along with the commissioner's findings and determinations to the governor. Then we go into 435. Here, the governor may, right.
Mr. Chairman, just for folks who are watching at home, they should know that up until now, this is exactly the way the statute stands.
Yeah, right.
I think it's just worth pointing out that, that there's been no change in the statute in what you've been reading so far as to what's in the books right now.
It just, but I wanted to make that very clear in the language that's proposed so that we follow the sequence. A, the governor may transmit a contract. He doesn't have to, but we would assume that he would. Under this chapter to the legislature, together with a request for authorization to execute the contract. B, concurrent with the submission of the contract and request for authorization to execute the contract to the legislature, the governor shall, one, submit the commissioner's final findings and determinations and the financial, technical, and market data, including the work papers, analyses, and recommendations of any independent contractors used under AS 4382-240 that were considered by the commissioner to make the findings and determinations to the legislature.
Question.
Senator French.
If I may, submit them to whom?
To the legislature.
Okay. Well,
submit to the legislature.
That were considered by the legislature.
First word and the second to the left.
Submit.
Okay. Okay. Two, make copies of the proposed contract and material described in B1 of this section available to the public. C, after considering the material described in B1 of this section and other information it deems pertinent, the legislature may, by law, authorize the state to execute the contract forwarded to the governor. D, a contract developed under this chapter is not binding upon or enforceable against the state or other parties to the contract unless the governor is authorized to execute the contract by law. E, the state and the other parties to the contract may execute the contract within 60 days after the effective date of the law authorizing execution of the contract. Same provisions, just a couple, just laid out a little bit different and a couple added in. Mm-hmm. Then we go to the judicial review section, 440. Notwithstanding any other provision of law, a person may not bring an action challenging the findings and determinations relied upon by the legislature to authorize the execution of a contract developed under this chapter or the constitutionality of a law authorizing a contract enacted under AS 4382-435 until a contract has been executed and unless the action is commenced within 120 days after the date the contract was executed by all the parties to the contract. So there's another 120 days after the execution for someone to be able to bring a challenge. Senator French.
Well, I'm not sure it's another 120 days. It's the...
No, it's the 120
days. It's the 120 days.
Yeah. I mean after the execution, there is 120 days.
Right.
You're right.
Because that's the one time that we're envisioning a challenge.
Right.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Huggins.
What we have just gone through, I think, satisfies constituents that I've talked to that they want an open process. They want to get to a contract. They want there to be a point to contest it, but so that we can continue progress in getting a gas pipeline for this state. And I, quite frankly, I think this does it. You know, are there some things that need to be massaged? Maybe. I would fully concur, and let's go on forward with CS so that we can bring something back before us, openly air it, and see if we need to make any minor modifications.
Okay. Is there, Senator Guess?
I just had a quick question. I agree with Senator Huggins. The constitutionality of a law authorizing a contract. So it's not the contract itself. It's the law authorizing the contract. What would be challenged?
That the contract was entered into, but was not in the long-term fiscal interest of the state according to Article 8, Section 2 of the Constitution.
Okay. I just wanted to, because I can't imagine the contract that we're going to,
yeah.
The law that we're going to pass that allows the contract would be the subject
the law was
of
improper,
the challenge, but the contract
right.
would.
The law was improper because it authorized a contract that was not in the long-term interest of the state. I think that's how they laid it out. But I'll make sure with the drafters that we're doing it.
Okay. or that it wasn't, it didn't comply with the chapter, the Stranded Gas Act, not just the long-term interest, but the Stranded Gas Act.
Yeah. Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm comparing your Section 440 to the Section 440 that's on the books right now, and it looks very similar, and maybe I'm just not reading it carefully, but it looks as though there's, on the books right now, a person can challenge the enforceability of a contract executed under a law authorizing a contract.
Oh, is it?
Yeah,
where is that?
And I'm looking.
On 440, my current 440.
440.
The one I have is not numbered, but it's
okay.
Five lines, and you see.
Yeah, we can put that in there.
That would be.
Yeah.
I just want to keep it the way it.
I missed that myself.
It's easy. Yep. And I guess the only other comment I have is, and I think this just kind of goes back to the substance, not the timing. I think we're all in agreement on the timing, and I think this does lay it out nicely. But I just in changing the sort of focus of the legal contest from the commissioner's final findings and determination, which we had a good explanation from the Mr. Ostrowski how that's a term of art that's sort of something that the legal community is comfortable working in, both judges and lawyers on both sides of what will be a certain court battle. And changing that from the findings and determinations of the commissioner to the findings and determination relied upon by the legislature, which is what's proposed in the document we're looking at, that's my concern. My concern is I can't know for a certainty that we're not shrinking, if you will, the avenues that a litigant might have and shrinking the amount of information that might eventually be discovered through that challenge. And that's my concern.
Yep. It's a very difficult thing, and I've struggled over that because it's difficult to challenge the actions of the legislature in passing a law. It really is. And because if we did, as we've discussed earlier, if we were to say that the new contract or the contract that's brought out and given to us does not meet the requirements of the law, we can still accept it, mm-hmm. and it becomes effective because it's a new law that authorizes it, and it supersedes the old law and the requirements. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, if I might, though, I think what I heard Senator French say was that, be that as it may, that maybe the words connote a narrowing of things that would be available to people that were challenging. I think that's what you said.
That's my concern. I can't say for certainty. Yeah. That's my concern.
I can't either.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I can't say for certainty how it's going to be treated, but in the intent, at least at this committee and hopefully the legislature, is not to narrow the scope of a challenge, but to properly place it.
Yeah.
And
it's
base.
It's not about timing, or it's about timing, not about information available to be challenged.
Yeah, and under the old law, I think we had a very clumsy situation that would allow a high centering, but it also had, I think there were a lot more arguable points. But I will say that it's very even difficult for us to say that the legislature must consider those findings.
Yeah.
It's very difficult. But if they don't consider the findings that were given to them, then they're acting in a manner that's not in the financial interest, long-term financial interest of the state, and will allow that to be challenged on that basis based on the findings were incomplete, the findings were erroneous, the findings were fraudulent, whatever. And I think we're still allowing the challenge to be on whether or not that contract meets the long-term fiscal interest of the state. That's our intent. Now, how that plays out, you know, on the record, the court's going to look at, see what our intent is. I believe they're going to look at the wording, but our wording is, and so we have some time, but I'm going to submit this to the drafters over in our Ledge Legal, get their comments to make sure that we're on as solid ground as we can, and bring this back to the committee on Tuesday as a CS that we can do the final examination of before we forward it to the body. So in the meantime, if you can find some better words to be able to carry out the intent, anyone, we're more than willing to take a look at them. I think we're all on the same page on intent. Mm-hmm. Now if we can just make sure that we don't end up with a product that the 98 guys ended up with. And I will also amend the title of this act, because I don't think it was ever the intent of the committee to eliminate an opportunity for some kind of judicial review of what we would call the findings or the determination to make sure that they were, in effect, complete and, in effect, accurate and a sound basis on which to make a decision. So, okay?
Sounds good.
Just before we close, I'll be, you know, the one thing I'll be looking for is to just to restate what we've said all along, is to keep the legal challenges as open and as whole as possible, and just put that timing off. And just to let you know, Mr. Chairman, I'll probably be trying to get us back to focusing the challenge on the commissioner's findings, even though I recognize that at some level we're adopting them and they're subsumed, if you will, within the vote on the contract. That's just kind of going to be the direction I'm aiming.
Yeah, and that's the difficult part for me, is because they are the commissioner's findings. But in order to come to a contract, we have to rely on those findings to make sure that we are, that the contract is in the long-term fiscal interest of the state. So I think we are challenging the commissioner's findings, but only based on their reliance because they were erroneous, they were fraudulent, whatever. They were inconclusive, or they were incomplete, or the commissioner didn't give us the entire record to be able to look at. So with that in mind, let's see if we can do that. And I will, at this point, tentatively, we'll schedule this for Tuesday. We have another fairly heavy schedule on Tuesday, but we will be able to move that backwards if we need to. Yes. On Wednesday, we don't have anything scheduled for Wednesday or Thursday, so we can yep. String the calendar out a little bit. Okay?
Sounds good.
Any questions? Hearing none, is there anything else to come before the committee this morning? Seeing none, this committee is now adjourned, and it's 17 minutes till the hour of high noon.
Noon.